Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege once again to present Peter Vogel, the author of The Last Wave from Port Chicago. Peter, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks, Dave.
Now, we've been talking about the Port Chicago explosion and your long odyssey into political and scientific research in order to get to the bottom of the mystery surrounding what actually caused that explosion. Now, in our first half hour, we've been developing a very compelling body of evidence that points to Port Chicago as a nuclear explosion. One of the elements that naysayers have brought up frequently in an attempt to discredit your hypothesis is that, well, if it had been a nuclear explosion, there'd be tons of radiation and we would know this. If you would address that criticism.
Well, tons of radiation, even in a conventional sense, is wrong. The Port Chicago explosion, the nuclear weapon that was detonated there, was actually a very small, very low-yield weapon. So the type of radiation that people consider would have been at Port Chicago following, comparable to the Nagasaki or the Hiroshima test, you know, it just was not physically possible for it to exist. Nonetheless, the question has to be answered, was there residual radiation at Port Chicago? And in order to be able to get some information about residual radiation resulting from nuclear weapons, the most immediately available material is that which was available to the British civil defense people following their first nuclear test in the western islands of Australia, the Montebello Islands. It was Operation Hurricane, which was a 25 kiloton prototype plutonium implosion weapon. Now, the British really wanted to know very badly what would be the consequences from the point of view of residual radiation in a British port if an atomic bomb had been carried into a British port in an innocent-looking merchant ship and detonated. So one of the principal research purposes of Operation Hurricane was to track the radiation that would be consequent to Operation Hurricane. And what the British found is that after 10 years in the area surrounding that test in the Montebello Islands, after 10 years, the residual radiation had decreased, had just merged with the background, this normal background radiation that was present there before the explosion.
Now, again, the background radiation level for the hurricane test was measured how many years after the explosion?
It was measured continuously for 10 years. And at the end of 10 years, the authorities of the British government permitted people to go in and picnic in the area where the atomic bomb had been detonated in the Montebello Islands.
In other words, the background radiation level was within what was deemed to be acceptable levels within 10 years.
Yes, actually it was deemed to be comparable to the natural pre-existing background radiation.
And this was with a 25 kiloton weapon.
That's so. Now, that doesn't really address the immediate radiation concerns that would have been present at Port Chicago. And that's a little more difficult because there really is no radiation data available for small weapons tests. And especially there is no radiation data available for the type of weapon that was detonated at Port Chicago, because that was unlike the Hiroshima and Nagasaki weapons in that it did not use pure uranium and it did not use pure plutonium, but used a hydride form of uranium. And the fission spectrum that would have resulted from the explosion of a uranium hydride bomb is entirely unknown.
Now, but briefly, before we get to the Mark II, the uranium hydride bomb, the hurricane test, the British test, was of a 25 kiloton weapon, and within 10 years, the radiation level was back to background level.
That's right.
Because people have often said, well, gee, you know, if Port Chicago had been a nuclear explosion, there'd still be radiation up there. And even if Port Chicago was many times more powerful than it appears to have been, that would not be the case.
That is absolutely correct.
And what do you estimate, before we get to the Mark II, the explosive power of Port Chicago to have been?
The total explosion, the energy yield of the Port Chicago explosion, in my by my calculations, was approximately 2.1 kilotons TNT equivalent. And of that total, 2.1 kilotons, the weapon, the Mark II, that was detonated at Port Chicago produced an energy yield of 600 ton TNT equivalent.
As opposed to 25,000 for the hurricane.
That's correct.
This, again, for people to compare, because a number of people said, well, if it was a nuke, there'd still be radiation there. And as we mentioned, that's not the case. Peter, were there any? Is there any indication that any of the survivors, or perhaps even any of the people who passed away, had flash burns characteristic of a nuclear explosion?
There are two indications that there were severe burns that resulted from the explosion in some individuals who were exposed. The information on that is not, however, reported in the subsequent Naval Court of Inquiry that looked at the cause of the explosion and the consequences of it. There was one man who was operating as a ferry captain on the Sacramento River who reported that many very severely burned individuals had been transported by the ferry across the Sacramento River to receive medical attention. What type of burns those were, we don't know. The second case is more interesting. There were two medical doctors in the United States Army who immediately after the explosion treated many of the individuals who were injured at Port Chicago. And those gentlemen reported to me probably 10 years ago that they had treated severely burned men and that the burns at that time had seemed to them to be unusual, but they didn't know how to distinguish those burns from any other burns. Those men then became radiologists in private practice in Los Alamos. And it wasn't until they had finished their internship or their residencies in radiology that they recognized that the type of burns that they had seen among the Port Chicago survivors were, in their opinion, radiation burns.
So there are some indications that there were radiation burns on survivors.
Yes.
Now, Peter, we've been going about Mark I, which was the Hiroshima weapon. We could mention in passing, to be taken up in a couple of minutes, that Mark III was the plutonium implosion device that was dropped on Nagasaki. We have been talking tangentially about a Mark II, and that's central to our discussion. Tell us about the Mark II. What was it and its significance?
We've looked at Mark I, which was the gun assembly, highly enriched uranium weapon that was detonated at Hiroshima. Mark II was an entirely different weapon. It was the first of the implosion assembly weapons that were developed by Los Alamos during World War II. Mark I was a gun assembly weapon. Mark II, Mark III, and Mark IV, which was actually the weapon detonated at Nagasaki, were all implosion assembly weapons. Now, what that means is that a subcritical mass of fissionable material, either uranium or plutonium, was compressed to a very great degree by high explosives, which, by reducing the cross-section of the fissionable material, permitted a nuclear explosion with actually less material than was required for the Mark I gun device. Now, Mark II was the second weapon design, and it was essentially a pipe bomb, and it was designed in this fashion. A mild steel pipe of approximately 9 inches interior diameter was wrapped with a blanket of uranium hydride, and on top of that blanket of uranium hydride there was a blanket of paraffin impregnated with the isotope boron-10. Boron-10 is a neutron absorber. These layers of uranium hydride and paraffin and boron-10 on top of it were overlaid in probably 6 or 7 layers around this pipe. Around the blankets of uranium hydride and paraffin and boron, a very heavy layer of high explosives was wrapped. And into that high explosive, there were many fuses, detonators set around the circumference of the pipe. Then the bomb was encased in a heavy steel case, and probably within the case there was a layer of depleted uranium, which acted as a tamper. Now, when the high explosive was detonated in the Mark II device, it heated and melted the paraffin and boron 10 layers and essentially blew those out the end of the weapon. And the force of the implosion then consolidated the several layers of uranium hydride at the center of the device, so that these subcritical layers of uranium hydride, when they were consolidated, became supercritical and exploded. Now, the uranium hydride is very interesting material, and there is almost no references whatsoever to the uranium hydride gadget. And there are several reasons for that, two principally. One, that it's a very simple atomic bomb to build, and the second, of course, that it was tested at Fort Chicago. So for those two reasons, information about Mark II and the uranium hydride have been excluded from the available literature on the Manhattan Project. Now, the first reference that I have found to the uranium hydride gadget occurs in a memorandum of the 21st of August, 1943, a year and a month, or just less than a year, prior to the Port Chicago explosion. And this is a memorandum from the Military Policy Committee on Atomic Fission Bombs to the Vice President, Henry Wallace, to the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, and to the Chief of Staff, General George C. Marshall. And if we go back to page 12 of this secret memorandum of 21 August 1943, we find that the Vice President, Secretary of War, and the Chief of Staff are advised that there is a chance, and a fair one, if a process involving the use of a hydride form of material proves feasible, that the first bomb can be produced in the fall of 1944. So we have the Military Policy Committee telling the leaders of the United States that if all goes well, by the fall of 1944, the first atomic bomb using the hydride material will be available. And of course, the Port Chicago explosion occurred in the summer of 1944.
Specifically in July, we're just past the 51st anniversary as we speak on August 1st of 1999.
Mm-hmm. 55th, wasn't it?
Yep, 55th. Mm-hmm. Didn't I? Well, no, I missed. I said 55th. Anyway, with regard to the Mark II, you have obtained some correspondence among some of the principals involved with the development of this weapon, which not only indicates a lot of concern or preoccupation with the Mark II, but also with something called the B damage radius. If you would B damage radius. If you would explain to us what the B damage radius is, and then talk about some of this correspondence.
All right, I'd be glad to do that. An explosion causes three types of damage among structures that are affected by the blast wave from an explosion. The most severe category of damage is Class A damage, and that's everything flattened. Nothing stands in the area of Class B damage except perhaps the rubble of heavily reinforced concrete buildings. Class B damage is damage to structures which is so severe that the structures must be torn down. And Class C damage is damage which can be repaired and the structures put back into service, whatever their use happened to have been. At Port Chicago, Class A damage was 1,000 feet from the source of the explosion. Class B damage at Port Chicago extended to 2,500 feet, or approximately 1/2 mile from the pier where the ship exploded. And Class C damage extended on out to about 12 miles.
And so, again, now the B damage radius is something that's important. Now, Peter, you obtained some correspondence from some of the principals involved with the development of the atomic bomb, and that correspondence proved to be very, very revealing. I wonder if you would share some of those insights with us.
Well, the first substantial reference then occurs in a memorandum dated July 4th, 1944. The explosion at Port Chicago, of course, was July 17, 1944, so this is just earlier in the month. And these are memoranda that were prepared for General Groves by the president of Harvard University, James B. Conant. On the 4th of July, 1944, Dr. Conant writes to General Groves and reports on the progress of Mark II. And what he says on the 4th of July is that we are confident enough that Mark II can be made to work, that General Groves should inform the Joint Chiefs of Staff that Mark II is a viable weapon and would be available within 60 days, subject to one proof firing. Now, and he continues to say, if Mark II is successfully proof fired, it can be put on the shelf, and he designates it as Mark II, and work can proceed with less nervousness on the more powerful bombs.
Now, this, what was the date on that?
That's 4 July 1944.
It was about 2 weeks before the explosion.
Yes. And the information that's particularly interesting there is that Dr. Kona tells General Groves that General Groves and the Military Policy Committee should inform the Joint Chiefs of Staff that Mark II is a viable weapon, that it will need to be proof fired once before it's available for combat use. Now,
and again, they said that basically, if the B damage radius proves sufficient, then we can put the Mark II on the shelf.
That's correct. The next document is actually more specific about that, and this document is dated on the 27th of July, 1944, and records a conversation that was held on the 17th of July at the University of Chicago.
Now, this compares with the actual date of Port Chicago. How, again?
On the 17th of July, the date of the explosion, there was a scientific meeting held at the University of Chicago, at which Dr. Oppenheimer and Dr. Conant and General Groves and others were present. In a historical note that Dr. Conant wrote on the 27th of July, 10 days later, he records the substance of the conversation that he had on the 17th of July at the University of Chicago with Dr. Oppenheimer, and he says, he proposes that Mark II, that plans be laid as soon as possible for a test of Mark II, and if it should work, it could be put on the shelf and work could proceed with greater confidence on the more powerful weapons. Now, that's on the day of the Port Chicago explosion in the morning.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the explosion took place about 9:15 at night, wasn't it?
Oh, no, it was 10:30 in the evening.
10:30 in the evening,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
And given the time differential there, there had been no word yet at the University of Chicago that the Port Chicago explosion had occurred.
Sure.
There are several references to Mark II and the fact that everyone expects it to work between the 17th of July, 1944, and the 17th of August, 1944, 1 month later. On the 17th of August, Dr. Conant is at Los Alamos, again meeting with Dr. Oppenheimer.
And this is a month after Port Chicago.
Exactly, 1 month afterward. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Conant then wrote a memorandum to General Groves reporting the meeting that was held on the 17th of August at Los Alamos. It included Dr. Oppenheimer and Captain Parsons and several others who were involved in the development of these weapons. And Dr. Conant instructs General Groves that the decision had been made at Los Alamos on the 17th of August that Mark II should be put on the shelf and could be developed for combat use within 3 or 4 months' time if all other implosion methods should fail.
Now, once again, this is a document a month after Port Chicago, and most of that document was redacted, Peter.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the most heavily redacted documents I've ever seen. It is, and it also has one of the highest classifications that I've ever seen on a Manhattan Project. It is not only stamped secret three times on each page, but it is also stamped restricted data and not declassifiable.
How many pages is it?
This is a two-page document, Dave.
How much of it was redacted?
Everything on the top page except one sentence.
Okay.
Is redacted. And that sentence reads, it is agreed that Mark II should be put on the shelf for the present. If all other implosion methods fail, it could be taken off the shelf and developed for combat use in 3 or 4 months' time. Now, what that means, Dave, mm-hmm. is that if it is available for combat use in 3 or 4 months' time, that the proof firing of Mark II, that Dr. Conant had said on the 4th of July was required, that somehow, somewhere, that proof firing has actually occurred, because there is no further mention of the fact that the weapon needs to be proof fired.
Was that was there any other aspect of the document that was not redacted? Any other things you can read to it?
Well, yes. On the second page of this document, Dr. Conant goes on to say that if the explosive lens development for Mark IV, the Nagasaki weapon, looks very bad, it may be necessary to work on improving Mark II to see if at least the upper limit of effectiveness cannot be raised somewhat. So you see, at this point, on the 17th of August, 1944, Los Alamos is aware of what the limit of effectiveness of the Mark II is. Well, I mean, that's the basis of probably not calculation, but the reports that Captain Parsons and Dr. Shapiro and Ensign Reynolds had put together in the days of following the explosion.
And again, Captain Parsons not only conducted the supervised the bikini tests, but he also was the bombing officer aboard the Enola Gay that dropped the Mark I on Hiroshima. So again, in the beginning of July, they're saying if the B damage radius is sufficient, then we'll know that the Mark II works. We can put it on the shelf and move on to other things. And how did the B damage radius for Port Chicago compare with the specs that were required for Mark II?
Well, in this same 17 August 1944 document that Dr. Conant sent to General Groves, he says, note on explosive damage. It was agreed that Class B damage was damage beyond repair. For the phrase to be of significance, the type of structure must also be named. It was agreed that for dwelling houses, the area of Class B damage was about as follows: for 1,000 tons TNT, 90% Class B damage, 1.5-mile radius, 2,500 feet, which is the figure for Class B radius from the Port Chicago explosion that had been provided in earlier analyses by Dr. Reynolds. Dr. Reynolds, who visited the Port Chicago explosion from Los Alamos, determined that the radius of Class B damage from the Port Chicago explosion was 0.5 mile.
So in other words, basically about what they required.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And bear in mind that, again, in August, a month after the explosion, a document was there was a letter, and only virtually the entire two-page document is redacted. And read us that one sentence on the first page that was not redacted, because it's critical.
It really is the only one. The title of this document is Report to General Groves on Visit to Los Alamos on August 17, 1944. About two-thirds the way down the page, the only text that's available says, it is agreed that Mark II should be put on the shelf for the present. If all other implosion methods fail, it could be taken off the shelf and developed for combat use in 3 or 4 months' time.
You know, and it'd be interesting to find out what the rest of that document had. If that's what they didn't redact, what did they redact?
Right. Well, I did apply to the Department of Energy to have this document entirely redacted or entirely uncovered. And in that request, that FOIA request, I had the kind support of former Secretary of Defense William Perry. And he had added his voice to my FOIA request, saying that he believed that these documents should be declassified. Notwithstanding former Secretary of Defense Perry's intercession to have these documents released, when the FOIA request was finally processed, there were only 3 or 4 additional words that were uncovered, and those words are of no significance.
We're going to get some recent experiences with the Freedom of Information Act in your search, Peter. One point I want to note in the last couple of minutes of our interview is that shortly after Port Chicago, in fact, in August of 44, you point out that work at Los Alamos switched to the Mark III implosion device.
Right. In fact, it was work switched from emphasis on other weapons developments to the implosion assembly technology. Mark III was an implosion technology, but it was the precursor of the Mark IV Nagasaki weapon. Mark III was a spherical weapon that could have used plutonium or enriched uranium. The explosive charge which detonated the Mark III was not, like Mark IV, focused. So it was a much less efficient weapon than the spherical implosion weapon that was finally developed and used at Nagasaki Mark IV.
Point being that it was right after Port Chicago that the main emphasis at Los Alamos switched to the Mark III.
Well, that's right. And at that point, Los Alamos was confident that Mark I, the gun assembly weapon used at Hiroshima, confident that mechanically it would work. And they had Mark II, which had been tested at Fort Chicago. So, and they moved ahead with the only weapon which was likely to be able to use available plutonium, and that was the Nagasaki weapon.
Peter, we've only got a couple of minutes left. We've got to speak very quickly here.
Sure.
You recently had some very frustrating experiences with another Freedom of Information Act request within the last month.
I mentioned the fact that there's 7 linear feet of material from the Fort Chicago explosion at Los Alamos National Archives. And in May, I requested the director of Los Alamos, Dr. John Brown, to make all those materials available to me since the archivist wouldn't. And finally, at the end of 30 days, I was told that I needed to make a FOIA request to obtain those materials, which I did, and then learned that all those materials at Los Alamos had been reclassified and are not available. The irony of that, Dave, is that all of those 7 linear feet of materials at Los Alamos I had seen and reviewed in 1981. They had been declassified on November 13, 1979. They had been re-reviewed and declassified on January 1973 and re-reviewed on November 14, 1989. So all of those documents I had seen, I had had my hands on all of them. They had been declassified 20 years before, and all of a sudden a FOIA request was necessary to obtain them, and that FOIA request has been denied, and the documents are now reclassified and unavailable to anyone.
And combining that with the other aspects of cover-up, Edward Teller's reaction that you had a classified document that he'd never admit to seeing, the dissembling about the amount of fissionable uranium that was available, the different characteristics of Fort Chicago explosion from a conventional explosion, the white flash cloud, etc., the reclassification of the Army and Navy explosives technical paper, explosive safety board technical paper number 6, the top secret, right after your article was published, the dissembling about the film of the Fort Chicago, actually a nitrate-based film which was not in use in 67, the destruction of records for 2 railway cars which were shipped from Los Alamos and unloaded to onto the EA, Brian, the missing cancer records for Contra Costa County for the 2 or 3 years after Fort Chicago, the indications of radiation and other things, and in particular the remarkable document that you read to us, in which the one unredacted sentence on the page, on the first page, says, well, now we know that we can put Fort Chicago on the put Mark II on the shelf and ready it within a period of weeks if needed. I think you've created a very compelling picture of what Fort Chicago was about, Peter, and on behalf of the American people, I want to thank you.
Thank you very much, Dave.
All right.
Stay tuned.
Okay, well, that concludes this interview for Peter Bogle. This is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.